What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Greg Foss has 32 years of experience trading high yield credit and capital structure arbitrage. He is the executive director of strategic initiatives at Validus Power, and he's a founding shareholder of 3IQ. He has his bachelor's in mechanical engineering from McGill University and an MBA in finance from Cornell's Johnson Graduate School of Management. Greg Foss, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
I'm doing really well, Cedric. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, man. It's awesome to have you here. You know, I think you're one of the most interesting voices in the space right now. I really like how we get to geek out on some of this sort of finance stuff. And you make it incredibly interesting, which I haven't found in a bit since I've heard your voice. So I'm happy to get into it. Sure. I'd love to hear. One thing you brought up, and I just kind of want to touch on it, is there's a lot of Canadian Bitcoiners. And
it's surprising, and I'm proud to be part of that group. But I think I use the expression, we sort of punch above our weight in that class. I continue to meet very talented, certainly everywhere in the world, but Canada, it's a nice, solid group, no question.
Sure. I mean, I was kind of a little like, well, you know, it sounds true. And then I went through my catalog of episodes, and I just started name after name from Ali Hammam, Chris Gimmer, Jeff Booth, John Ballas, Jesse Berger, and I'm sure there's so many more. So that's pretty cool. I don't know if anything's different up there that kind of gives you guys an advantage. I'm not sure.
That's a really, I haven't thought of it in that way. Not like we're, you know, we are no different, the way we think in the, across provinces. So there's, I wouldn't say there's anything, specific to any given province in Canada, but, one thing I do find, so you mentioned guys like, John Ballas out on the East Coast, and then Chris Gimmer in Ottawa, and just, I love that, bitbo.io.
Yeah, I love it too.
Dashboard is fantastic. I think there's, you know, one thing I always find is there's a lot of engineers and financially, comfortable, Bitcoiners, in Canada. And the truth is a lot of them actually keep a low profile, whether they're working for some of the big Canadian banks and are, you know, don't want to bring attention to themselves, given, potentially some conflicts of interest, let's put it that way. But it's a great group of Canadians.
Yeah, I like people who keep a low profile. I think it's a smart idea. I want to hear more about your background as a trader, specifically in high yield credit, and sort of your knowledge and experience in these markets. One, how did you get your start in your career?
Okay. So, well, you mentioned I was an undergrad at McGill, engineering. And then, I pretty quickly realized I didn't want to be a full-time engineer. In fact, it was 1 week into my first semester. I didn't want to be an engineer, but I liked the mathematics. I was at McGill playing sports, and, I said, well, I don't really know what I want to be. You can always switch from engineering to business, but you can't go the other way. So if you're 2 years into business, it's not like you can turn around and you have to start from scratch in engineering. So I stuck with it. Happy I did. But was always looking to other opportunities. And I did go down to school in the US, and that was a great experience. As an aside, got to experience the US, the difference between our two countries, which doesn't appear to be that large on a day-to-day basis, but there are certainly I lived with eight other guys, and just really got to understand the difference, some of the subtleties between Canada and the US. As an aside too, one of those roommates actually died on 9/11. So I did experience the heartache of a nation brought to its knees. So I came back to Canada really quickly, and I started my career in finance at Canada's largest financial institution, the Royal Bank of Canada. And One of my first projects was working on the Latin American debt restructuring proposed by Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady. And it was an eye-opening experience for me, very simply because not only was Royal Bank of Canada in a precarious position, every other money center bank in New York and large banks globally had all lent too much money to Latin American countries, and they had defaulted. The debt was trading at about 25 cents on the dollar on average. And if the banks were to write down, and this is key, if the banks had to write down their loans to market, i.e. take a 75 cent on the dollar write down, the Royal Bank of Canada would have been insolvent.
Right.
And that's not picking on Royal Bank of Canada, because every other, you know, I mentioned the U.S. money centers at the time, Bankers Trust, Manufacturers Hanover, Chase Manhattan, all these banks have since combined, but they were in the same situation. So it was my first eye-opening experience. I'm like, holy moly, this is crazy. How do these banks maintain the confidence of the deposit base? And quite simply, it was, came quickly to my mind, they're too big to fail. How the government bail them out? By printing money. So at the time, that was my first introduction to the potential fiat, the money printer. So yeah, so I perhaps 1988, I will honestly tell you, I didn't know what the solution was. It was just an eye-opening experience for my understanding of the true leverage in the financial system. Banks at the time were levered probably close to 25-1, meaning they had 25 times liabilities for every component of equity capital, their loss absorbing capital. So very simply, on a $100 loan, a typical bank, a bank would have $4 of equity capital and $96 of deposits or subordinate debt. Then you can understand how that system can, you know, quickly get marked offside. And Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady, brilliant solution. He switched a 5-year obligation into a 30-year loan, a 30-year obligation backed by zero coupon U.S. Treasury bonds. And the banks did not have to write those loans down to market, because over time, the zero coupon bond accretes to par. And therefore, that's a money good obligation. Quite a smart solution. And the banks globally had to pick between two options. One was called the par option. The other was called the discount option. It had to do with fixed or floating interest rates, price of oil, components, optionality in the payout. But ultimately, those bonds traded from 25 cents on the dollar to well through par, just because of the impact of interest rates, falling interest rates. And here's the neat thing. I said to my CFO, I go, like, you know, I really like these things. We should go out and buy more. And what do banks do? Oh, no, thank you very much. I bought enough at 100 cents on the dollar. I don't want to buy any more at 25 cents, right? So that was my introduction. And then, yeah, I've been through some crises on a fairly regular basis. It's sort of like you can set your watch by them. 1998, you know, 1988, 98 was long-term capital. 2008 was the scariest time ever. The great financial crisis. And then again, 10 years after that, almost 10 or 12 years, COVID. So
right.
that's where we are.
Yeah. You've definitely had quite a scene. I wonder, you know, especially seeing the first one at such a young age, and I'm sure you looked at academically, maybe, you know, the crash of 1987.
Oh yeah.
Junk bonds and Michael Milken.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
You had some thoughts there, and here you have this revelation that, you know, there's tremendous leverage in the system, and a haircut would wipe a bank out if it didn't have a backstop. And I'm wondering what, and you know, going through your career, maybe you have survivor bias, but I'm wondering, you know, what you thought of your peers, especially your older peers, and what their reactions to your revelations were, and whether they had the same revelations or not.
So great question. You know, I mean, certainly I don't want to throw anyone under the bus, because, you know, not many people understand how banks truly work, right? I mean, even bankers, many people that work at banks have no idea the true leverage, 25-1. Those who know, try and keep it quiet. And that's the truth. I'm not going to say I had to sign any non-disclosure agreements, but the truth is that I sort of became quite enamored with pricing risk and correctly pricing risk. And that led me to come to try and develop.
Hold on one second. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm so sorry. Come on in. So sorry about that.
No, it's all good. It's cute. Okay. It's very cute. So basically, you know, pricing risk became a focus of mine. I like to say there's always a price. Don't tell me there's not a price. I could take you down, you know, various ideas, you know, on how to properly price risk. But what it came down to is I said, there's no high yield junk bond in Canada. And I essentially became the first high yield trader in Canada, high yield credit trader in Canada. We had a company in Canada called Rogers Communications, which still exists, but it was at one point in time, Ted Rogers put together a beautiful cable TV and wireless plant, Rogers Communications owning these assets. Ted Rogers was the largest high yield bond borrower in the world, not in Canada, in the world. And he was funded through Merrill Lynch, and Merrill brought all of Ted's debt to the very developed high yield market in the US. You mentioned Michael Milken. Yeah. So Milken was the guy that developed, you know, saw the same sort of thing. And, but Canadians did not embrace it. So I sat in that chair and had some interesting stories about how a Canadian account would own the equity of Rogers Communications, but wouldn't own the bonds because the bonds were junk, you know, and they wouldn't buy the bonds, even though they have a prior claim in the capital structure at any price, Cedric. There was no price they would buy it.
And was there a difference here between Canadian then and Wall Street American type traders?
You know what I find about Wall Street? Well, generally Canada, we're pretty good risk takers on the equity side.
Right.
I was joking, you know, we would fund a gold mine in Africa, but you know, with no cash flows, but you're looking for a mineral deposit, but God forbid you should own a bond in a company that's deemed junk, like Rogers Communications, that pays a really healthy coupon. It wasn't free cash flow positive, but it was on its way to building and now is an investment grade credit. And, you know, so we took all our risk on the equity side, whereas I found the US guys were always willing to expand various silos, whether it was equity, debt. The derivatives market certainly is way, way, way more developed in the US than it is in Canada. So we pick our spots.
Yeah. Before we get into back into the equity side and understand that a little bit, like, so what were you doing on the credit side and what are the credit markets? How big are they?
Sure.
And what is a credit default swap?
Okay. So I was a high yield trader. And I was working for the sell side. I was working for a company called Toronto Dominion Securities, TD Securities. It's the division of one of Canada's largest banks. I worked in Canada as well as on Wall Street, or lived in New York. But I did trade, you know, even when I was working in Canada, I did trade. Most of my accounts traded through US, or most of my action was through the US, because that's where the market is, the Wall Street high yield market based out of Wall Street. So what I would do on the sell side is I would manage a portfolio of these bonds on a principal basis, which means if a client came to us and we had underwritten a high yield deal as an institution and they wanted to buy or sell some of the bonds, I didn't have to take an agency order. I would say, okay, here's my book. This is my bid offer. You know, the bonds are 96 to 96 and three quarters bid, 96 bid, 96 and three quarters offered. What do you want to do? And I maintained that trading book as a service to the clients that purchased our new issue debt. I would trade other fallen angel credits and take principal positions. I traded credit default swaps in that two separate hedge funds. And that's really where things are exciting, because you're not constrained by any internal bank meaning, you know, somewhat strange policies as well. One of which is, you guys probably all remember a company by the name of Nortel. Well, Nortel was a huge high yield bond issuer. It had fallen from investment grade to high yield, and then it became a high yield bond. But there was no price that my risk management at TD Securities would allow me to own Nortel bonds. Yet the equity desk, which was just across the hall from the bond desk, they could trade as much Nortel common as they wanted. Yet I couldn't buy and own. I could be short it with a 10 and an eighth coupon. It's an expensive short. But at the end of the day, there's just even in, within banks, there's some misallocation of trade. Oh, equities are so liquid. I can get out of those anytime I want. Oh, there's the perception of liquidity and there's the reality. So yeah, so I worked on both the buy side and the sell side, and I'd be happy to talk about the credit default swap market. Or do you have any other questions on that?
It's interesting. What do you think about, I want to hear more about the reality of the equity in terms of their liquidity. And
the perception of liquidity in equities is amazing because, it trades on a screen and everyone thinks, oh my goodness, but if you look at the actual volumes and the market values of how much equity in a given name will trade, you'd be surprised. You can trade 10 million of their bonds right on the screws. If you tried to move $10 million worth of equity in a perceived market that's quoted on the screen, you can really move that stock, and the market may be, let's just say it's a $5 stock with an enterprise value of $5 billion, let's say. Okay. But the stock, if the enterprise value is $5 billion, let's just assume the stock might be $2 billion, just for a number of market cap. If you're trying to move $10 million of stock on a $2 billion market cap, the quoted market and where that sort of size trades is a lot different. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's why you see, the tape, everything goes, and then they have to knock it down, cross a big chunk of stock down at this price. And then usually the market will flip back up towards its prior quoted. And so that's what I call the perception of liquidity. The reality is credit markets are much, much larger, much more liquid than equity. That's true in any country. That's because it includes most, all countries have their own government debt, and those debt obligations have no subordinate equity. Whereas a corporate balance sheet is the one that generally has the senior claims and then the subordinate claims, right?
Right. What about the difference in size of these markets and really, really, who really has the better judgment of risk?
I'll be biased, but even some equity guys always say, you better watch what the bond guys are doing, right? There was words called bond vigilantes, what really happens in the bond markets. I'll tell you one thing for sure. Every single credit crisis that I've lived through, which is four, it always starts in the credit markets. It never starts in the equity markets. Credit markets are about four times as large as the equity markets on a global basis. Okay. So there's so many internal and the leverage in the credit markets is so substantial that if the plumbing, I call it the plumbing of the credit markets, starts gurgling, it flows down the capital structure to where equities sometimes get really whipped around. And many equity guys don't understand why that's happening, because they're operating in their own silo, which is the equity markets. And, they don't look outside that often. Whereas the bond guys tend to have a more macro, training. And, I'll say for any equity analyst that does not know, firstly, the credit rating of the companies bonds, and secondly, the price at which those bonds trade. And I'll bring it up. I mean, this is quite common. I'm not picking on anyone, but there's, an editor of a very large influential financial magazine in the US made a statement that, you should go out and buy the equity when the bonds were trading at 40 cents on the dollar. I mean, that's just irresponsible journalism. Right. The bonds happened to be the equity, and the equity that he was recommending people buy was a super out of the money option. Now, if you're going to take your risk, the return on those bonds, the equity ended up going to zero, and the return on those bonds was somewhere in the area on an annualized basis. They went from 40 cents up to par after the restructuring. On an annualized basis, it was something like a 12 multiple. That's where you take your risk. You take your risk in the part of the capital structure that is protected to the downside or has less downside. And right. you can call a bond a senior equity. You can call an equity a junior or a subordinate bond. It's just sometimes these silos get, people say, oh, it's an equity and therefore it has to trade relative to where other equities trade. If you look at the world as an enterprise value, it becomes a lot easier to analyze the companies, and you'll quickly see how the leverage, if it's, as I said, I laid out in that example before, if it's a enterprise value of $5 billion and the company has $3 billion of debt, you better learn where that debt is trading. Mm-hmm. If you're taking a position in the subordinate claim that has a market value of $2 billion, but unless the prior claim is worth $3 billion, that equity is worth zero, right? And therein is the risk that a lot of people don't understand.
Yeah. How do you reverse or change that risk? Let's say you have a large equity position, a large institution. How do you use something like a CDS as an insurance and change your position mid-flight?
Great, great question. So if there's a price for everything in the capital structure, you can do various hedges. You can be hedged and wedged in different ways. Meaning, let's say you own the bonds and you take a short position in the equity to hedge out your default component of the bonds. But you don't do it on a dollar for dollar basis because, first of all, you're hedging a recovery value. You're not, or a loss, if you will. There is a recovery value, typically around 40 cents on the dollar in the bonds. And you do it on a vol adjusted basis. You do it with, you most likely would use equity options rather than taking a short in the stock itself. Then it all becomes a volatility trade. And then you have to worry about deltas and gammas and all these beautiful Greeks of the option world. And it's exciting. And it's sometimes, so my boss was a Harvard Business School guy. When I worked at the hedge fund in the Great Meltdown, and I was putting on a trade that was 100% risk free. I was buying the bonds of a company, a Canadian company, whose bonds traded in the United States, but the equity traded in Canada. And this company, I was able to buy their bonds, and it was about a 6-month bond remaining to maturity. I was able to buy their bonds probably around 65 cents on the dollar. And I was able to go to the options market and purchase a put option on the common stock that made the trade absolutely risk-free. And I could basically bank risk-free over 150% annualized return. And now the market was melting down. But I show my boss, I showed Jason, he was the CIO. He goes, "You're not doing this trade. It's impossible. It can't possibly exist." And I go, "Jason, I'm doing it." And the hard part of it was getting enough option, purchasing enough of the put options, because that's the illiquid side of the trade. But I was doing it, and I'd done, $3 or $4 million worth. And he goes, "This is unbelievable. Again, it's a textbook example. It should not exist." And I go, "I'm doing it." And I ask him, "How much can I do?" And to his credit, he goes, "Do infinity." Okay. Yes. Do infinity. And I loved it. And I just wanted to stand up and give him a hug because that was the right answer. Now, the world was absolute calamity. But the funny thing was, seeing the equity in Canada, have no idea where the selling in the equity was coming from, because the option guys that were selling me the options needed to delta hedge their equity. Okay. Delta hedge means basically you have to take a short position in the equity. If you've sold a put option to me, the guy that sold it to me has to run out and actually hedge his own position, which means he's shorting the common stock. It's called delta hedging. Okay. And they were getting trounced because there was some clown in Canada that was just purchasing all these put options, and no one could figure out where the underlying selling in the equity was coming from. And my boss had just told me, "Do infinity." Pretty cool, right? Yeah. And anyway, it was the trade actually worked out, obviously. The ARB never got to be unprofitable. It's just, again, the options maker basically just said, that's it. I'm out. I'm not selling any more of these options. I don't understand why some guys just every time I put up an offer, poof, sold to me. You know what I mean? So yeah. It was exciting. But then again, it was a part of the time in the world when there was a lot of exciting stuff going on.
Yeah.
Scary, exciting.
In that kind of moment, is that an ongoing trade, or is that you lock in a large position and then you just have to wait out your position?
The easy part was buying the bonds at 65 cents on the dollar. Okay. The hard part was hedging that position in an illiquid portion of the capital structure. First of all, the stock, it was a $2. The stock was trading slightly above $2. And I was buying a $2 put, and it cost me about 40 cents, if I remember correctly. So I was paying 40 cents on $2. That's 20%. That's a 20% cost. And I was buying bonds at 65 cents on the dollar that had 6 months to maturity. So 65 cents on the dollar, that's 50. You know, there's the thing right there. I was paying 20% to earn about 140% to the upside.
Right.
And so paying 20%, earning 140%, you net the two out, and there is my over 100% annualized return with no risk. Right. And again, I loved my guy. He was running to a meeting, do infinity. And then he'd come back. How much were you able to do? Well, again, I bought 2 million more bonds, but you have to go into the market and hedge that 2 million position, right?
Yeah, I wondered, one, how horrible it would have been if you had a bad risk manager there who didn't give you the green light because he didn't understand the risk-free nature of the trade, how much money that would have cost you, the organization.
You know, I've lived it in other ways where you're sitting on a position and the only on a bond that you know is not money good, and you want to short the equity. And I've actually been told, no, you're not allowed to short that equity. Now, whether there was an investment banking relationship with that equity or whatever, you never get told the real story. But the company actually did file. And, I got pretty beaten up on my bond position because I did not have a hedge because I was not allowed to short the equity. But the answer to that is, You never leave a risk-free trade like that on the table. The markets, someone else will sniff it out, and that's why you have to move pretty quickly.
Yeah. How much do you think over the course of your career, like if you had to think about how you spend your time, would it be like selling your ideas and versus like coming up with your ideas and
yeah, research? No, I manage money on behalf of clients, and so you try and do it on a stealth basis. You don't advertise to the world you're doing it because if someone else understands you're doing it, they'll do the same thing, right? So you don't let it be known. You have to find these things. You have to do it in a stealth, and you just put it on. You live and die by your own decision and that of your team as well. So your risk manager that was able to say, you know what? This is a trade that we would put the entire fund in. That's basically what it was saying. We were managing about, at the time, the fund was about $700 million. Now the debt outstanding was only about, on that issue, was probably about, it was probably $150 million deal. Mm. And if it was trading at 65 cents on the dollar, there was maybe $10 million worth of the debt for sale at 65 cents. Right. And you could ask yourself, who in the world was selling it at 65 cents? Well, someone who thought, that 65 cents was a good price to exit because it would not mature in the next 6 months. And if it didn't, it would go from 65 down to probably 40 cents on the dollar.
Right, right. I'd love to hear, you explain a little bit about what long-term capital management was and what that meant for the markets.
What a mess. Yeah, what a mess. I mean, so this was a fund. You got to read that book, When Genius Failed. Absolutely amazing book. And the genius was two Nobel Prize winners, right? Anyway, the two guys, two Nobel Prize winners, if memory serves, they were levered about 90 to one. Okay. They had 90 to one leverage, and they were selling volatility to the street, which meant they were selling protection. Cause when you're selling volatility is protection, and in any credit instrument, that's what you, the way you have to think about it. So if you're selling vol, it means you are an insurance company that is sold a protection, and the street kept running to long-term capital management for more protection. And there was a line in the book, I don't understand this. They're exceeding 99% confidence levels because vol had shot up and was trading at like, you know, 85%. It's exceeding 99% confidence levels. And they had based their entire thesis on 7 years of data. That's pretty embarrassing, right? As a Nobel Prize winner, that's pretty embarrassing that you would put that type of risk on 90-to-1 leverage based on 7 years of data. Come on, guys. I mean, but that was it. So yeah, that was scary. And so it got bailed out, right? Because it had to, because Wall Street bailed out their crony capitalism. And an interesting story on that front is one of the guys that was against bailing out long-term capital management was Dick Fold, who is the CEO of Lehman Brothers. So one of the reasons 10 years later that they said they let Lehman fail was as payback for, this is rumor, urban myth, potentially. One of the reasons they let Lehman fail was as payback for that event 10 years earlier.
It's a very, that I've heard the story, what I can't understand is some of the logic here. It okay. seems a little mafia logic, but because one, I think he's arguing for conservatism is what I'm guessing at the time. Okay. And are they sort of arguing for, we don't care what your argument was, you would have let any of us go. So that now that it's your, like if.
I think so. You know, and let's, how about we don't go there? There's just, sure. It's too small a street, right? You don't,
yeah, no, I
you
understand.
You got to really understand that at the end of the day, there's really like 15 guys that run the whole thing. And the reality is when you're levered in the financial industry, like everybody is, because that's the way finance works, you just got to be really careful who your friends are. And who sure. your enemy and who your enemies are. And, yeah. You know, I mean, there's you guys got to read a great report or these reports that I love reading, a report called the Bear Traps Report. It's put together by a former high yield trader who actually passed in memory of a former high yield trader that passed away. One of the best credit default swap traders on the street. But, you know, when it comes right down to it, it's a very small group of people, yeah. very small group of institutions that all are intertwined. And, you know, if AIG were to have failed in the great financial crisis, Goldman would have failed because Goldman had purchased so much credit protection from AIG. And then Hank Paulson, who was an ex-Goldman guy, was at the, you know, was coordinating the rescue of AIG, et cetera. So look, I mean, it is what it is.
Yeah. And then I guess, what did you see in the great financial crisis?
Oh man, no, scariness. You know, it's very simple. Like I did actually think it was over. There were times I was, you know, taking the train to work in. So it really got ugly after Christmas in 2008. And then the spring of 2009, January, February, March, 2009 was absolutely crazy. Citibank preferred bonds were trading down at 25 cents on the dollar. Now, all the U.S. money center banks had subprime leverage exposure that none of the Canadian banks had, okay? Yet, there were Canadian banks that had U.S. dollar similar structure preferred outstanding as Citibank. And so I was working at the hedge fund. My former company, though, TD Bank, had a preferred structure that was out in the market. It was selling at distressed levels only because Citibank was. Now, TD Bank had zero subprime mortgage exposure. Yet the market brought everything down. And on an equivalent basis, the same debt in Canada was trading at about 11%. And you could buy it in the US market at close to 40% yields. Okay. So right there, there's a 30% arb between countries that just have a different perception of what the true risk is. Well, if Citibank is going to fail, well, TD Bank, this crappy Canadian bank, has got to be failing too. Well, not necessarily if they didn't have the same subprime mortgage exposure or structured product risk that Citibank had, right? But it just, the contagion brings everything down in the market. So my boss, the same guy, Jason, we had worked together at TD Securities, and he felt that TD was a rock solid. on a relative basis, much more solid investment than Citibank. And he's like, yeah, well, we're buying these in the US market. We're going to hedge them in the Canadian market and we're going to ride that spread, right? And that's another example of, wow, they're just handing you these trades that you just have to take advantage of because of cross-border arbitrage.
Right. Did you see the movie The Big Short?
I did, sir.
Would you say that that was a fair representation of some of the dynamics that were going on at the time?
Even better. It was outstanding. The flip side to one of those ones is there was a product in Canada called asset-backed commercial paper, which was another one of our incredibly involved trades. They had issued in 2007, there was an asset-backed commercial paper product, asset-backed commercial paper, 90-day asset-backed commercial paper that was bought by Canadian institutions because it was non-bank secured asset-backed commercial paper that they were earning 6 basis points more than the equivalent bank commercial paper. And the asset-backed commercial paper was based on leveraged super senior debt in the US, investment grade debt that they were packaging, selling into Canada. And Deutsche Bank and JP Morgan and the big investment banks in the US had these huge buyers in Canada of this structured product in the US. Well, that market, that product, it had maybe $3 of subprime mortgage exposure in it. So if the typical tranche was $100, let's walk through the reality. They were selling it to Canadians at close to $100, 100 cents on the dollar. The true value of it was probably closer to 92 cents on the dollar. And the US investment banks were taking out huge chunks of VIG, right? Vigorish, because they had these stupid buyers and they would buy the stuff in Canadian, do their alchemy and sell it into Canada. So let's say it was trading at 90. It should have been trading at 92. Foolish Canadian institutional investors were buying it at, you know, 99 cents because of the $1 being the commercial paper maturing in 90 days. Now, the funny thing is it was a 90-day rolling term, but the stuff was 5 years. It was based on the investment grade CDS credit default swap market in the US. And so you had a 5-year asset that was funded with 90-day rolling commercial paper. Mm-hmm. So it was worth 92 with $3 of subprime mortgage exposure. You take that out, you assume it's $89. You mark the subprime down to zero. It's 89 bucks. Well, the market froze. The guys did not roll their 90-day paper. Mm-hmm. And it was actually a precursor to the credit crisis. And that same debt traded down, you know, 60 points from where it should have been. So if 69 was, excuse me, if 89 was the true value of it after taking out all subprime exposure, it traded down into the high 20s. Mm. Okay. And we were buying and we're like, this is, you know, these guys don't understand. First of all, they didn't understand what they were buying. And secondly, then they didn't understand what they were selling. Okay. And they just started selling and but there's 32 billion of it, Cedric, 32 billion as a Canadian market. And I'm like, you know, I could not believe that they were selling it down at these levels, but they were. And we got overwhelmed by the amount of people that wanted to smack our bids. So we turned around and recycled it and we picked off stuff that we liked and then sold it back into the US market where hedge funds in the US had figured out the same thing, but they didn't see the selling dynamics because the accounts were Canadian. So again, if you insert yourself in the right spot, we could recycle stuff, sell off the risk that we could replace easily, the generic stuff, and right, keep the stuff that was specific to the packages that we bought. So coming back to this movie, The Big Short, it may have been a book, or about the Michael
Lewis wrote book, it.
The Big Short, where some guy at Deutsche Bank is shorting this stuff prior to the crisis happening. Who are these idiot buyers buying this subprime stuff? Well, the specific thing that he referenced was a tranche in the structure in Canada. So there was a subprime mortgage tranche, even though it was 3 cents, that particular tranche was in the structure And he's like, and he's shorting the stuff. And he's like, who are these idiot buyers? Sort of like Michael Burry was saying, who are these buyers? Like, they just don't, well, they're dumbass insurance companies that are buying it because it says it's a AAA product or AAA rating, even though it's trading at a spread that would not even come close to being a true AAA credit risk, right? Right. So there's, you know, rating agency arbitrage, all that stuff that goes into these. And this actually started, though. This was a precursor to the global financial crisis because this stopped rolling in Canada in 2007, 2 years prior. Okay. Right. Same idea, though. It was concerns about U.S. subprime mortgage exposure, but that was the canary in the coal mine for us.
Yeah. You speak about canary in the coal mines. I mean, for me, the physical markers and the market, you know, itself as a marker were very different. I felt them, you know, obviously they're intertwined, but what I'm getting at here is I returned home from California, from San Francisco, where I was kind of in a bubble. I was 25 years old, just kind of doing my thing. Okay. And I get home to New York and I get back to my parents' house in the suburbs and I'm in my old neighborhood. It's 2005. And sometimes I take the dog for a walk and I could look around and I could see that everybody was adding to their house. Everybody was doing things to their house that cost tens of thousands of dollars. Everyone had brand new cars, very new cars. And knowing, you know, kind of being disconnected from the neighborhood for a while and coming back and knowing that it was a middle-class blue to white collar neighborhood that most people couldn't probably afford these without easy credit. That was kind of my physical marker of what was going on. And kind of what I'm getting at here is now we've kind of walked through three of these cataclysmic events.
Yes.
And kind of what do you see going on now? And we can get to some of the bigger stuff maybe with nations, but what do you see?
The bigger stuff because so each successive crisis transferred risk from the financial system's balance sheet essentially to the government. Okay. And so the big one in 2009, the great financial crisis, was a wholesale transfer of risk from the finance industry to the balance sheets of governments. And the governments were in okay shape prior to that, but they took on a tremendous amount of debt to stabilize the system. And the problem was they didn't pay back that debt. In fact, they continued the same policies called QE this or, you know, QE two or QE three, whether it was money printing or a troubled asset relief program, you know, the TARP, T-A-R-P, troubled asset relief program to bail out these institutions. So they never stopped increasing the leverage. So we hit 2019 COVID, 2020, with leverage that was at historic high levels that should have been paid down when times were good, meaning the economies were, but every time the Fed tried to taper, you heard the expressions, the markets are having a taper tantrum. The markets were addicted to Fed easy money. And by those markets, generally that means the equity markets, because everybody always looks at the equity markets. But yeah, that's what, you know, you hit the nail on the head. It's now there's nobody else to transfer the debt to. It's actually on the government's balance sheets. There's nobody else backstopping the governments. And that's why I believe Bitcoin can be looked at as default insurance on fiat issuing credits, i.e. sovereign nations.
Right. And along those lines, why do the interest rate markets hold no clues for us?
So they're manipulated quite simply, right? I mean, it used to be a open market for pricing risk. But when you have an elephant in the room in the form of a Fed that buys $120 billion a month of mortgage-backed securities and government debt, that shape of that curve is biased. It's not reflective of true open market capital pricing of risk. So interest rates are where they are, but I argue don't look at the interest rate market. That's a combination of inflation expectations in an open market, not one that's manipulated like it is right now. In an open market, it's always a combination of inflation expectations as well as a credit component. Where it was minute in the past, this credit component is obviously growing right now. Mm-hmm. And that's where you look at the CDS market. So people would say, oh my God, the US Treasury will never default. And that's by and large correct, certainly in the past, but they have defaulted. You could argue 1971 was actually a technical default where they, but at the end of the day, right now, the US Treasury has to pay a certain spread that's not zero. They don't pay it. Rather, people who want to insure US Treasury debt pay a certain spread that's not zero, indicating there is credit risk in the US Treasury. Same thing for Canada. It's much worse in Canada, but then you can go right down the line of, you know, largely G20 countries where you get to countries like Turkey and Argentina that have CDS spreads, credit default swap spreads that are very substantial, indicating various levels of financial uncertainty on the credit quality of that issuer.
Sure. Yeah, I kind of want to level set here in terms of, so we talked about CDS and credit default swaps. How do those compare to like CMOs and credit more, you know, and CDOs?
Okay. So
and the size of those markets. So are they different kind of products? Are they similar? And what are the differences in size?
So the interesting thing you brought up, CDO. A CDO stands for a collateralized debt obligation. Okay. A CDO is a structure. Here's the funny thing. You actually had CDOs and then CDO squareds. Mm-hmm. CDO squareds were structures based on CDOs. So you had a CDO squared that bought other CDOs, and those CDOs had exposures to generic interest, generic credit risk, either in the corporate world. You brought up, I think you said CMBS, didn't you? Or what was the other
one? Collateralized mortgage.
Okay, so that's the same thing. So that's a mortgage. Same thing. Okay, so, so CDS tends to be typically corporate. It really got its start in the corporate market, and they put together credit indices of 125 different issuers in the top issuers in the US. That indice you can trade like on very liquid basis. That's how Bill Ackman very astutely went out and purchased a whole bunch of credit protection on his on the US CDS index. He was a buyer, and he essentially was buying the protection to hedge his subordinate equity portfolio, but it was an upside down trade. And if he felt that this pre-COVID, they were selling this insurance premium too cheaply. And he made a big, big pass, didn't he? Because that premium that he bought, the value of it expanded, and he was able to flip it out and book a huge mark-to-market gain that hedged his mark-to-market losses in his equity pool. Very smart. Upside down trade. That's not typically how you do it. Generally, you short the subordinate piece to hedge the senior piece. But again, if the senior piece is trading at a dumb level, and on a volatility adjusted basis, it was much cheaper for him to purchase the protection up here rather than using the options market or other volatility instruments in his actual equity tranche, then he took that. And the sellers of the protection are typically insurance companies that, you know, oh, this is cheap. And by the way, I'm leveraging it 4-to-1. So, if I'm selling it at 70 basis points, but I'm leveraging it 4-to-1, all of a sudden that 70 basis points becomes a meaningful amount. But what if that 70 basis points turns around and starts trading at 400 basis points? Oh my God, the mark-to-market loss on that position, which is where Ackman purchased it, was the mark-to-market gain because he was the buyer of the protection. So this is, again, this is hedging and wedging yourself in capital markets that can be mispriced on a relative basis.
Yeah. What kind of size of these markets are we talking about in the total value stacks? Like, what are equities worth?
Yeah, so equities,
credit markets.
About call it 100 trillion equities globally, and credits, you know, four times that.
Okay.
So, credit. And then don't forget, CDS is a derivatives market. Okay. Derivatives have gross notional exposure and then net exposure. Because for every counterparty and for every contract that's written, there's a whole ton of netting that goes out. So the derivatives market just dwarfs the actual cash market. But that's because there's so much netting that takes place, right? But I can't even give you a number. I would, I mean, I've seen, actually, here's a good one. I had this, I printed this article. I wonder if I have it close at hand. But the global derivatives market, darn, hold on, stay with me. I think is the guy that wrote the article quoted a number that blew me away. Here it is. 2.3 quadrillion global time bomb. I don't even know what a quadrillion is. I know what it is. Okay.
Being facetious, but I get what you mean. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, this was a great thing. But yeah, if it's 2.3 quadrillion, which is 2,300 trillion, is that 2,300 trillion? 2,300 trillion. It is 8 times the size of the credit markets. It's 6 times the size of the credit markets. Okay. So credit markets are 4 times the size of the equity markets, and the derivative market is 6 times the size of the credit market. So therefore it's 23 times the size of the equity markets.
Yeah. It's very interesting. Markets. You know, there were times where I feel like on Wall Street or these big, large organizations like Goldman Sachs, you would hear that like the current CEO is from the credit side of the house.
Okay, yes.
Or, you know, the equity side of the house. And it seems to come in waves. Yep. Where do you think we are right now in terms of who runs
the great street? Question.
And just in macro sense, and I know they're all sharks. You get sharks on both sides of the house.
I cannot answer that. I will tell you that, strangely enough, for example, Solomon Brothers, you know, the old Solomon Brothers, mm-hmm. that was always the credit side that ran Solly and John Gutfriend. I've been on that trading floor where you still, you know, his desk and the cigar that was his notorious cigar. But everything at Solly was run by credit guys or fixed income guys, because they were the masters of the universe. You remember that that book? I think that might have been Bonfire of the Vanities, Masters of the Universe. I mean, these were all about the bond vigilantes. And then, yeah, on a regular basis, you get a Morgan Stanley CEO that came up through the investment banking side or the equity side. But sometimes he's a credit guy. Right now, I would just say everybody is smart enough to know to look to the plumbing of the credit system. Because if you're a subordinate claim like equity and the credit system's not working, it doesn't matter what's going on in equities. They're not working 10 times worse. And again, they're getting flung around. So everybody has to look to the credit markets for early warning signals.
Yeah, fair enough. So what do we see right now in the current, you know, the yields around sovereign nations and particularly maybe North American nations?
So are you saying absolute yields or credit default swap spreads?
Which one do you think is more indicative of
100% CDS? Okay. Because again, the yields are manipulated by and large.
Let's look at the CDS. Yeah.
So So let's look at the two countries in North America. Strangely enough, Canada actually maintains a AAA credit rating from S&P, whereas United States is AA+. Okay. It's one notch below. The US is actually rated one notch below Canada. Now, you can rate it whatever you want. The reality is the world trades off the United States. Okay. That's just the way it is. Lots of it comes from its number one rank as the economic powerhouse. And the second is because of the global reserve currency. But the reality is Canada, in theory, has a higher credit quality according to these credit rating agencies as AAA. But if you look at the credit default swap market, the United States trades right around 10 basis points and Canada trades around 40 basis points, which means the market is telling us that Canada is actually much closer to a single A rated credit on a true risk basis.
Right.
And the United States is, you know, generally trading right where a AAA credit should. AA+, AAA, it's one credit notch. It's semantics. But no, yeah, Canada's in big trouble. All right. And this is my country. I have three kids. And we got these politicians out there that are oblivious to this. Absolutely oblivious.
I don't think we have to discuss credit rating agencies too much. I think that the market here is telling us the truth and what we to know.
Absolutely.
Where do you think we are, though? Like, you know, at the very beginning of the conversation, we're talking a lot about how Brady and some of the great decisions that were made back in 1988.
Okay.
And like, do you think there are being great decisions being made now? Do you think things are different now, or just on the same spectrum and sort of like we're on a path that like we knew we would be at based on what happened over these past three decades? Or are there other choices that could be made?
Yeah, wow. You know what? So I don't believe that there's enough people that truly understand it. You know, there's various people out there. And let me be very clear, all right? And I'm borrowing this line from Leon Cooperman. Lee Cooperman famously states many times, he is a capitalist at heart, but he's a capitalist with a heart, okay? Meaning he understands the need for social programs to help, you know? So, but while we both agree, he and I, certainly I don't hold a candle to him in terms of his experience, but, you know, in terms of the capitalist system and the necessity for open market pricing, I have a heart as well. Like, I understand the need to stand behind our less fortunate parts of society. So the problem, though, is when you print money continuously, there is a cost to that. And I think the people that have the podium right now are listening. They love this term, modern monetary theory. Okay, I understand you want to print yourself protection or to help the less fortunate. But the cost of that is frequently overlooked. And that's why you need to look into the credit default swap market for true pricing. I'm pretty sure the modern monetary theorists have never truly traded a lot of risk in their life. Some of them are academics. You know, I mean, having lived it, there's truth. And that comes from open markets. You referenced it. Lee Cooperman would say the same thing. Look to the free market system as a true pricer of risk.
Right. Do you think we are in, like, so this will be the fourth major event of I would say our lives, but yeah. Do you think we're headed for sort of this one and a fifth 10 years from now? Or is this sort of more of a defined?
I hope so. Yeah. Well, I hope so, only because I don't think it's possible, okay? Meaning, like, the gig is up. It can't go any further. You know, these debt balances that we've amassed, it's mathematically impossible to grow ourselves out of the debt spiral that we're in, okay? Which means, very simply, is that fiat currencies are guaranteed to debase. Before, there was a fighting chance. They had debased over time because it's always easy to print money. It's the political, it's comfortable that if you print money, the public will love you and you can probably get elected for another term. Try and come into office being the one that's fiscally responsible and see if you actually get another term. I mean, the odds of that are much lower than if you're, you know, you're generous and you're printing your way to prosperity or, you know, these benefits. And I'm not arguing against the benefits. I just want people to understand the costs of these programs. And so where are we now? Well, look, I really hope this can continue. But like we saw an early warning system in 2007 in Canada before the global financial crisis started, I'm feeling the same types of warnings coming through the market right now. It's not reflected altogether in prices as much as the education level of people looking to the problems that are brewing. You know, there's a lot of smart people out there. And the bigger picture that you never realized back, even in 2008, the power of social media now, the freedom of speech that social media brings to the table allows many more people to get information that they otherwise would not be getting. Okay. So markets are truth, no question. I hope that in 10 years, you know, there will be... another financial crisis because it just happens. But the next one might be the, you know, might be the last one because there's no one else to take the risk anymore.
I think you froze on me for a second. Can you hear me?
I hear you now.
Okay, great.
We bounced or we froze a little bit. I guess I was just ending. You cannot transfer it anymore. There's no other buyer of last resort. We're at the limit that the governments can do. Well, no, we're not at the limit because they will keep pushing the limit, but there's nobody else to take that from the governments.
Right. I'm kind of curious. So, you know, you've stated you've been on this long journey to solve the problem of fiat.
Okay.
And so I'm kind of curious how you found Bitcoin, what you thought of it first, but I'm really also curious what the journey's been like for you in terms of your friends and family and in terms of like, you must've been talking about these kind of issues before Bitcoin.
Oh yeah, I was.
And I hear you've said that you're very adamant about Bitcoin now. And so has things changed in your personal life around?
They have, yeah. Thanks for the question.
Not your personal life, but just
no, that's fine. I will
tell professionally, you. But just the people you talk to about these things.
So I after completing the most profitable trade of my career, which was this asset-backed commercial paper restructuring, okay, where the bonds actually did, the restructured product went from 30 cents on the dollar back to 100 cents on the dollar. And this was a huge market. We ran a $1 billion fund and there was another 30 billion behind the amount that we could manage. Okay. Mm-hmm. It was for sale. Okay. So this was a slow process of creeping up the price, but it did creep up. We made some really, really solid returns and we believed we hedged out the true risks in the system quite smartly. One of the names in particular in the whole structure that was so critical was Hewlett Packard. So we could buy these tranches and then go out and hedge the entire risk of the tranche, in our view, with single name specific purchase of protection on Hewlett Packard. And people would be saying sometimes, "Who are the buyers of protection on Hewlett Packard? What is this?" And they didn't understand that this structure that had been sold into Canada, you could hedge the risk of that structure, a large portion of it, by buying protection just on Hewlett Packard. So there's part of the whole considerations of the contagion that exist in the markets. But so I had completed the trade and in 2016, our hedge fund was bought and I stayed for my 2 years. And then I said, I'm putting up my hand. I want to leave. I really want to be retired. And I tried to retire, but you never retire. You love the markets. So you start trading, you know, your own personal portfolio and you're always in the markets. And then some guy from my hometown in Montreal reached out to me and said, "Look, I'm trying to fund a company that wants to bring a Bitcoin fund to the Toronto Stock Exchange." And I'm like, "Bitcoin, okay, so I've heard about this thing, but I have to admit I don't understand it. But I'm an open-minded guy. I've read it's a Ponzi, blah, 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 but teach me it's not a Ponzi." And he showed me one screen where he showed me the blockchain in action, okay, on tradeblock.com. And you can see transactions hashing around the world and you'll see, you know, $85, $240, $27, $3 million flashing around the screen. And I'm like, what is this? Well, these are transactions that are taking place going into the mempool that are transactions. And this was in 2016. I'm like, so this is real. This is an engineering thing of beauty. I love this technology. This is actually happening. I can see it happen. Now explain to me about Bitcoin. He goes, "Well, there's only 21 million. I said, "What? It's got a fixed supply? This is beautiful because everything I've ever been involved with had no cap on the supply. And I was a quasi gold bug, but let's call it for what it is. Gold has a supply of about 2% annually, but it's not capped. Bitcoin was the most beautiful solution I'd ever seen. And yes, it was the anti-fiat that I was looking for. So in 2016, I really fell down the rabbit hole. I helped fund his company. I helped raise a bunch of money from my friends and family to fund his company. And we did win a court battle against the Ontario Securities Commission to be able to bring the first exchange listed closed-end Bitcoin fund to a regulated exchange in North America. That fund has accumulated over $2 billion Canadian of assets in a very short period of time. You do the rule of 10 to 1 US versus Canada, that would indicate a similar fund in the US would easily get 10 times that. Well, Grayscale existed at the time, but it's not a regulated exchange. It trades on the pink sheets. Long story short, I was proud to be part of this victory that allowed Canadians to purchase Bitcoin in their tax advantaged funds. You know, there's arguments, not your funds, not, I'm sorry, not your keys, not your coin. Let's be honest. Most of the money in the world lives in brokerage and savings accounts. And if you have the true Bitcoin maxis that are out there saying stuff like that, look, I understand it, but you're not going to attract the big money unless it's in custody accounts, like brokerage houses. So the fund got off the ground. It's I have sold my shares in that fund. But I also invested in pure Bitcoin in 2016, and I've been long ever since because I view it as protection against the world unraveling and central bank shenanigans. But I would have done far better just investing my money straight in Bitcoin. I did both, but I diversified, right? I diversified. I should have just gone 100% of my Bitcoin exposure in Bitcoin rather than the portion that I put into this company, because, you know, I bought Bitcoin when it was under, it was like $800 US, and now it's trading wherever. And the return I got on the shares of 3IQ was good, but it wasn't the same magnitude as Bitcoin. But sometimes you overthink it. But I am proud to be a capital contributor in that project, because Canadians, if you do a quick math back of the envelope, I think Canadians as a group have probably made over $500 billion because they were able to invest in Bitcoin at lower prices than it's currently trading. And that's a big nugget for Canada. That's $500 billion of, you know, gains that they otherwise would not have been able to realize quite as easily. Now, I own Bitcoin on a wallet before I get all these Bitcoin. Oh, you're not a real Bitcoin maxi. I own the wallet. I own cold storage. I own many different exposures to Bitcoin via companies. I'm involved in an energy company now that some of our big clients are Bitcoin miners. So it's a energy project. So lots and lots of different things. But in 2016, the engineer in me came back and I saw this and I said, this is so beautiful. It's the most beautiful innovation I've seen. And then you get a guy like Michael Saylor, who starts even opening your brain even bigger. Thermodynamics, you know, digital energy. Yes, I agree with all that. And you get a guy like him who's championing it. And, you know, man, things move, right?
Yeah, I'm blown away by your story. You know, I see, you know, I mean, to be primed and have the conviction you had, not just to get the idea your friend was talking about, not just to get what Bitcoin is about, not just to get what the hard cap policy is about, the engineering, the network, but then to, you know, to bring in your friends and family, which, as you said, I mean, everyone, I've heard this anecdotally, you know, on this show, but a lot of other places way more, is that you always do better just going into Bitcoin than anything you could do around Bitcoin, even though you think, oh, I'm going to spend some Bitcoin and do this Bitcoin company, and then we're going to make Bitcoin, and you'll never outpace true pure Bitcoin.
I will be I think that's true for me. Yeah.
And I think it's just, you'll hear from everybody. And yet it's in that regard, I think it's a donation or for the passion or the love, even in retrospect, you didn't do it to start out that way. I'm not, in retrospect, it's a donation. Yeah. I didn't mean you started out that way.
It wasn't philanthropic by any means.
No, right? I know, but it turns out that way.
Well, a little bit. Look, if you, I was happy to be part of it. I was happy.
But so my question there is, you know, it seemed like you, you know, I think there's a difference between people that were searching for Bitcoin their whole life and people who had problems that Bitcoin would solve their whole life and finding Bitcoin. And so I think you're in that first camp in a lot of ways. And so I wonder, you know, has Bitcoin changed you in ways that the prior 26 years of searching didn't already change you?
Well, you know, it would be interesting if you asked my wife, because there were times when I was not allowed to talk about Bitcoin at dinner parties, for example, like, you know,
right.
And, you know, so I was passionate about high yield bonds and bringing high yield bonds as an asset class to Canada, the same way I'm passionate about bringing Bitcoin as an asset class to Canadian accounts. Okay. It will be in everybody's investment accounts or pension accounts, because that's just the way efficient markets work. It was the same thing with high yield. It started off with one account doing it, and just after 20 years later, every single big account in Canada has high yield bond exposure. Whereas 20 years ago, zero of them did, because you know, that's just the way they managed money in Canada. So I think the same thing will happen with Bitcoin. I'm passionate about Bitcoin twice as much as I'm passionate about high yield, because it does solve so many other problems, including the fact that, you know, it's a store of value that I feel very comfortable building up that store of value as a wealth transfer to my children.
Right. You know, I do want to turn more to Bitcoin.
Okay.
But right before we turn to Bitcoin, specifically energy and what you're doing now,
okay,
where do you think like pension insurance companies are in terms of their structure and sort of their risk management, and how Bitcoin can play into that?
Well, again, it's being led out of the United States. Again, you know, why? Because they typically get things quicker and are more apt to break down the barriers. And I'm talking about the institutional investment mandates. So, you know, there's not any meaningful Canadian company that I'm aware of along the lines of a MicroStrategy or a Mass Mutual, New York Life, Morgan Stanley. None of the Canadian banks have embraced Bitcoin like JP Morgan in the US has, after fighting and, you know, clawing and scratching against it. They realize, okay, my clients want it, so I'm bringing it onto my platform. Goldman Sachs is now reporting it in their attribution analysis, even though 12 months ago they were saying it wasn't even an asset class, and now it's there and it's at the top of the asset performance, not only on the basis of return, but also on the basis of a Sharpe ratio. So, you know, it moves quicker in the US, but over time it will be everywhere. Why? Just because it's a risk bucket that hedges. I believe it's the perfect hedge for fixed income. I think fixed income could be one of the least attractive asset going forward. When I started trading in 1988, US Treasury 10 years were double digits. And, you know, they went from double digits all the way down to 60 basis points in February of last year when COVID hit. Now they're at 165. Like, fixed income right now is not going to be the same as fixed income was for the last 40 years, where in 1982, you know, US treasuries were close to, you know, 16-18% in the 10 year. My God, like, what a different. So fixed income right now, I don't like high yield for on a valuation basis. I think that the base level of interest rates are manipulated by and large. So should it be 165, or should it really be in an open market? What would US 10 years be? I'm guessing sort of like 280 to 3%. So there's just that much of an elephant in the room compressing US 10 years. And then there's these inflation scares, and we've never done anything like this in my life with the money printing. You have some big names calling out inflation concerns. I will say that, coupled with the credit concerns, and we're in for some world of hurt in the fixed income asset class.
I really, you know, actually, you know, I have a question for you.
Sure.
What do you think, you know, I guess what should people who are 60 to 80, 90 years old do right now? And I'm not asking for investment advice, actually.
I love you, man.
Back that up.
Okay.
But like, how should they frame up, like, you know, just, I don't know, risk management or, you know, sort of portfolio management in very high, I'm talking 100,000 feet.
I know.
You know, like.
Well, they've lived a great return, right? I mean, bonds generally have always been thought of as capital preservation vehicles. And equity is your capital appreciation vehicle. And then high yield fits somewhere in between. It's a combination of pricing for risk that allows you to earn capital appreciation if you make the right credit calls. So at the end of the day, we talked about the general level of interest rates. You know, if you were 60 years old 40 years ago and you put most of your investment into bonds, that was brilliant because you were getting a 15% annualized contract that, you know, from the US Treasury. And why was that? Well, because Paul Volcker in 1982 went out as a war on inflation and raised US interest rates to the point where the 10-year was trading at 16%. Can you imagine 40 years ago, just say, okay, blindly, yeah, I'm done. 100% of my portfolio into fixed income bonds. And you ride that down for 30 years because you bought the 30-year treasury at 16% and you basically were a rock star.
Right.
And that doesn't exist anymore. You can buy the 30-year treasury right now at 2.5%. But that 2.5% a year ago was 1.5%. And that 100 basis points increase in the 30-year bond, which is now a 29-year bond, because a year ago it was 30 years, has cost you $22 of capital loss. That's what happened if you bought a 30-year bond a year ago versus where it trades today. You've taken a 22% haircut. Now, you can say, oh, I'm going to hold it to maturity. And okay, all you've done is you're holding a low coupon bond that is now you know, it's giving you a 1.5% per year payout, contractual payout, when now they're paying 2.5% on it. It's only bond math. It's look, I don't know what I would do if I'm 60 to 80. I'm almost 60. So I better tell you what I'm doing. I own zero bonds. Very simply, I'm short bonds. Okay. I'm long volatility. I'm short bonds. I'm long equities. I am long Bitcoin and I'm comfortable. Okay. And I just tell you, having spent my whole career in bonds, this is the first time ever I've not been long bonds.
Right. What about cash? Where does cash fit into
that? Well, that's short term. Call it short term cash. Cash and bonds, I put those in the same,
okay,
you know, in the same bucket. Cash, though, you know, cash is your liquidity. It's your life raft. If you're in the bond markets, please, I would argue, don't extend your maturity or de facto duration and convexity out past a 5-year term. It's just not worth it. Like, you know, the Fed's going to sit on the short end of the curve. It'll protect you there, but the long end will get whipped around. And like I said, 1 year ago, you bought a bond at par and it's now trading at 72 cents on the dollar. It's been a long time since US Treasury debt has traded at 70 cents on the dollar.
Yeah.
But that's where the long bond is from a year ago.
Right. Well, let's turn to the fun stuff.
Okay.
And, you know, we talked about how there's a lot of Canadian Bitcoiners on the scene, but you're actually putting Bitcoin in Canada with some of the work you're doing now, building on the work you've already done with the closed fund. But tell us a little bit about like what you're doing with the power company and mining and what sure. that what's going on there.
Well, thanks for the question. So yeah, I'm excited. So I fell down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and I need to so it really started hitting home for me as an engineer when you start thinking of Bitcoin as digital energy. Mm-hmm. And it makes a tremendous amount of sense for me that digital energy eventually is going to be used to price all energy related products. So I actually think that there will be a day at some point where oil and natural gas is actually priced in Bitcoin rather than in US dollars. And why would that be? Well, one very simple answer is there's tons of countries that don't actually love the US and they would prefer to receive it in Bitcoin or another reserve type of asset. Russia, for example, Venezuela, certainly. But you know, there's a lot of oil producing nations that that would see the value of transferring their natural resource energy into digital energy rather than into digital fiat or digital or US dollar treasury reserve assets. So I went down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and just a small world, I was introduced to this company that had spent 20 years in the power markets in North America, predominantly North America, but you know, projects around the world. And the founder is a brilliant young guy, not young, sort of my age, that sees the world like I do. And so he brought me on board because Bitcoin is the consumer, the marginal consumer of stranded energy around the world. Okay. I'll say, I believe that Bitcoin isn't wasting energy. It's consuming energy waste. Okay. And whether that's a grid that is not operating at peak efficiency because, you know, the grid is built for loads and it, you know, it runs at about 60% of capacity most of the time, whether it's that or one of the things we're focused on is flare gas, where we can wheel in a solution to actually capture the wasted energy in flare gas. You take the heat energy, you make electricity, and you capture the carbon, and arguably we are helping to clean the environment and create a revenue stream for an otherwise wasted resource. So the company's called Validus Power. It is a private company based in Canada, 20 years of history, although there was a name change. But this solution is eloquent in its scale. You know, able to, just to put it in perspective, 35 megawatt engines can get wheeled into a site. 35 megawatts of electricity is, you know, you can power a data center with 35 megawatts. These are big projects. These aren't, you know, small 1 megawatt projects that you're capturing flare gas from one single well. And this is exciting because you could argue that if Texas in an ice storm of this last winter, if they had enough of our turbines around the state operating on flare gas for mining Bitcoin, but then were able to flick a switch, if they were connected back to the grid to be able to sell power back to the grid rather than mine Bitcoin at that time. First of all, it would be way more profitable to sell power back to the grid because the grid needed it. And secondly, it would have stabilized the grid rather than these rolling blackouts that were taking place. Yeah. So there's just a lot of good solutions. And it all comes back to the thing again, Cedric. It's yes, that's what Bitcoin is to me, is digital energy. And energy has always been a form of, you know, as humans use energy more productively, that improves the quality of life through, you know, and we've seen it throughout.
Can you give us a description of what's going on in Point Pelee and the, so the opportunities there with what you guys are doing? You
heard me talk on another, okay. So Point Pelee, this is an interesting geographical, Point Pelee is an island, not an island. It's a point. It juts out into Lake Erie. It's further south than Detroit. Okay. Because just the way it works is it, but.
And further south than some parts of California, I believe too. Well,
that's right. So the Northern California border, what's north of California, it's Oregon, right? So yes. Oregon, the California Oregon border is further north than Point Pelee, Ontario. And Point Pelee started as a tomato growing community where Heinz Ketchup, for example, was one of the largest production plants. But they've expanded their product offering to include all sorts of other agricultural food products. And then also recently though, marijuana and cannabis. And so these new plants, products that they're growing, they grow them in greenhouses in the winter. But in the summer, due to its location, it has a solid growing season in the summer that doesn't need greenhouses. But the greenhouses need to be heated in the winter. And the power grid is not able to supply them with the power. The grid is at capacity in Ontario. So we have this huge opportunity to export a bunch of stuff from Canada, but we don't have all the power that's needed to power the greenhouses in the winter. So we go down and we visit some of these guys. And in one of the meetings I said, well, guys, you know, you could have this turbine. And then in the summer, when you don't need the electricity for your greenhouse, why don't you mine Bitcoin? And they're like, you can't mine Bitcoin. And by the way, I can't afford a Bitcoin. It's, you know, at the time it's 10,000 bucks a coin. I'm like, you buy a fraction of a coin. What? You can buy a fraction of a coin. Anyway, you know, I got them to download Bitcoin wallets in the meeting. And then I transferred them Bitcoin in the meeting. And then they still call back and say, God darn it, I can't believe that $40 of Bitcoin you gave me is now worth, you know, seven times the amount, you know, that I wish I had done more. The point is, you're opening up eyes of people on a regular basis. The energy asset you could think of as being stranded would be a turbine, a 35 megawatt jet engine that's not being used half of the year. Well, why don't you use it to mine Bitcoin then? And in the winter, you heat your greenhouse. And then in the summer, you mine Bitcoin and your asset is not stranded because you're able to have a revenue stream on it.
You know, it's very interesting. I wonder what your confidence in the US dollar is and your thoughts on central bank digital currencies.
So that's a great question. Like, I mean, so every fiat is what it is. All of them are debasing or decaying, and there's various rates of decline. So everyone talks about, oh, I'm trading the US CAD, you know, US CAD, meaning USA Canadian. Yeah. Or I'm trading the pound versus the US dollar, etc. Look, guys, they're all going down. It's just at various levels of decay. And there's all this shenanigans on a foreign exchange desk. Oh, I'm such a great trader. The funny thing is, did you know that global foreign exchange volumes are about seven times global trade? Meaning six of the there's a six multiple of foreign exchange transactions that are pure speculation, have nothing to do with trade at all. Okay. That's what fiat foreign exchange is. All fiats are melting ice cubes. And you just have to realize that a digital currency, a central bank digital currency, would be just digital fiat with tracking, right? Digital fiat, they'll print more of it, guaranteed to debase, mathematical certainty. But they can also track your spending and say, hey, Foss, why were you at this anti-XYZ rally? I saw you were spending some of your digital currency at a restaurant that was on the route of, you know, again, these are some scary things. I'm not trying to call out the conspiracy stuff, but, you know, tracking is one of the benefits that a central bank digital currency could bring, together with some of the dangers. So I'm not a fan of, I don't view them as being a threat. In fact, I think as a digital currency would help the adoption of digital other crypto assets or other blockchain assets. I'm focused on Bitcoin for what it is. It's hard cap supply. And there will always be that differentiation. Okay. Unsound money is fiat money, whether it's digital or analog. And Bitcoin is sound money.
Yeah. When we think about price and value, again, this is not financial advice, but you know, we think about how we value and price a bond.
Yes.
And what how do we think about how do we value Bitcoin?
So I did a study based on my history in credit markets. I said, why don't we take the credit default swap rates of the G20 nations and take a cumulative calculation of what the credit default swap spread is for that particular country, multiply it by its funded and unfunded obligations, and add up, let's say, a G20 basket. And since I view Bitcoin as the anti-fiat, I would view the CDS time funded and unfunded obligations as a proxy for what the intrinsic value of Bitcoin would be at any point in time. And it would also be a dynamic measurement, because as the spreads, as the credit default swap premiums change under open market pressure, a wider spread, everything else being equal, would indicate a higher intrinsic value of Bitcoin. And I did that calculation about 3 months ago, and the results are still in the same vicinity. Bitcoin, in my opinion, is worth about between $110,000 and $150,000 US dollars a coin. Based on that calculation. Could it be wrong? 100% it could be wrong. But to me, it gives me an implied intrinsic value of this anti-fiat, hard-capped, fixed supply, sound money. And so that's what I think it's worth on a current basis. And again, that value will change as swap spreads increase as the world gets more risky, the value of Bitcoin goes up. And where can the value of Bitcoin go? I mean, I'd be happy to field any questions on that basis. But right now, I view it as being extremely cheap default insurance. And I also view it being as being a potential asymmetric trade, the best asymmetric trade I've ever seen in my career.
Yeah. So if this was 1988 and all things being equal considered,
yeah,
do you think you could get your risk manager from back then to approve your Bitcoin position?
Oh, no, man.
No,
no, because it's the same thing, right? I mean, there, and plus, you know, don't forget I was working for a bank then. And a bank is implicitly biased against its success, sure. Right? Yeah. It's just, you know, that's just the way it is. But would I be able to get friends and family to believe in it like I did have them believe in high yield bonds? And the answer is yes, I see it every day. Mm-hmm. Everybody who owns less than, well, everybody who owns zero Bitcoin is actually taking a tremendous amount of risk. That's very simple. If you own zero Bitcoin, you are taking extreme amounts of risk compared to a portfolio allocation. And I'll start with this. Yale says between 6% and 8% of your portfolio allocation should be in Bitcoin. It's a Yale University study. My opinion is that 6% to 8% should come from your fixed income bucket, meaning if your typical portfolio was 60% equities and 40% bonds, move that from 60% equities and 40% bonds to 60, 32, and 8. Okay. That will give you a lower portfolio volatility and a higher expected return. It's what you look for in non-correlated assets. So, you know, 8% is a pretty big nugget. And the funny thing is, let's say you get to 3%. The funny thing is, I'm almost certain that you will look at that 3% of your portfolio nine times as often as you look at the other 97% of your portfolio, right? So it's funny because this is just what people do when they get involved in a new asset class. And then you'll tell them, don't trade it. Don't trade it. Please don't trade it. Hold it as insurance. And what will they do? Well, it's gone up in price. I'm going to sell some because I'm the world's greatest trader. Like, and all they're doing is, you know, crystallizing capital gains. That's good, but might be still selling something that could go up so much higher from there. And then they'll get priced out of the market because human nature isn't to sell something and then pay more for it, even though you should, to get it back in your portfolio if it's going the way that that I think it could go. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, that's human nature. Is you got to balance all these or fight all these biases, whether it's status quo bias or your confirmation bias or your intellectual laziness. Like, oh, well, Jamie, you know, Warren Buffett says it's rat poison squared. So he must be right. Guys, you know, do your own work. There's always two sides to every trade. I will always say, though, that if you don't change your risk position as information changes, that's a surefire way of pretty well getting carted out of the risk management profession.
Yeah. So my final question in two parts.
Sure.
Is there's, you know, Michael Saylor and Elon Musk, and then there's Warren Buffett and Charles Munger. And, you know, and then along the lines of what Pierre's prediction, Pierre Richard. So do you think that the institutional investors will come into Bitcoin in the next, I'm going to say 1 to 3 years, sort of like more individual, but like large beachheads? Or will this be sort of like everyone's going to get a piece and rush in? And what I mean by that, so like Pierre Richard said, he thinks more than half of S&P 500 companies will have Bitcoin on their balance sheet by the end of this year. So that makes me think, wow. Yeah, that would be a huge stampede. So that makes me think, and it's a bold prediction, but so point being, it might not be true, it might not come true. But my point is, do you think a lot of companies are going to come in and take a position, or do you think this is still going to be, you know, pioneers grabbing a piece of
the
pie?
I have enormous respect for Pierre. I think he's a brilliant, he's smart mathematically. He's very astute. I've been on some podcasts with him. I'm impressed with his, certainly his analytical process, but that's a big number for me. I mean, here's the reality, right? There's an expression, you give a target, but not a time, or you give a time, but not a target, right? You give it's going to go higher over time. And 1 year from now, I think the price will be higher than it is now. And 1 year from now, I think the number of S&P 500 companies that own it on their books will be higher than it is now. But I'm not going to tell you half of them will. I mean, that's a big
bold. But do you think a lot of companies are going to try to get a small piece? Is this still going to be a trickle of companies getting a piece for themselves and not necessarily a small piece or large, but not a stampede?
Either way.
Of diversification by Wall Street. Yes, I don't mean a stampede.
Well, here's the thing. I think it'll be the bigger push will come from the asset management business rather than the treasury functions at S&P 500 companies. Mm. So the asset management business is far bigger anyway. Imagine though, if you're CalPERS, California
pension,
CalPERS, employees retirement system or something like that, sure. CalPERS, and you have a targeted return of 8%. That's that's what your bogey is for your to make your pension fund is funded. Okay, well, 8% when bonds are at 1.5% in the 10-year, and let's say all fixed income generally will be at 3%. If you have 40% of your fund in fixed income yielding 3%, that's 1.2% per annum that's coming from that portion of the fund. Mm-hmm. It means your equity and other components need to make up the difference. Means you need to get, if it's pure equities, you need to get 6.7% return on 60% of your portfolio. That means an annualized 10% return in equities. I don't think that's possible to count on. Therefore, you need other assets that'll come into this mix. And I think Bitcoin could be the most beautiful asymmetric trade opportunity I've ever seen. So if CalPERS put 3% of their fund in Bitcoin, but CalPERS is what? I think CalPERS is probably $500 million. So 3% of half a trillion. Mm. So 500 billion times 3% is 15 billion. 15 billion of buying power from one institutional investor coming into Bitcoin. There's mathematical correlations that would say that would bump up the price of Bitcoin itself.
Let's say CalPERS made that decision
yesterday
at the board meeting. They're going to make this move.
Mm-hmm.
Do they do that over 6 to 12 months? Do they, dribble in?
Look, they'll make the decision and then they'll take it to their traders, or they'll take it to a NYDIG, right? New York Digital Investment Group. And NYDIG NYDIG will help them manage the entry because, you can't just come in and say, I want 15 billion of this.
Right.
It's like any other market. There's the perceived liquidity and then there's the actual liquidity, right? Bitcoin right now is what, $1 trillion market cap. That is big from a relative to other, call it a company or enterprises. It would put it within the top 10 companies globally on an enterprise value basis, but it is not big compared to something like global fixed income, which is $300 to $400 trillion. Okay. And you start taking a piece of that and you say, what if 5% of $400 trillion moved into Bitcoin from the fixed income space? 5% of 400 trillion is 20 trillion. 20 trillion divided by 21 million. That's $1 million of Bitcoin, man. These are why it's the best asymmetric trade I've ever seen.
Right. What did you think of Tesla getting in and out with their principal, so or whatever they were trying to do there?
Again, he's proving that there is liquidity in the market. His board of directors were probably saying, geez, we look like pretty good. And human nature is to try and take some profits, test the liquidity of the market. If he was not free cash flow positive, which Tesla is not, they would have had to raise money in another capacity.
They needed the Bitcoin flow. That's how I read it. They needed that money.
That's what free cash flow is. Yeah, like if you don't have free cash flow, it means you have to continuously raise money to fund your operations. Now, over time, free cash flow generating companies generally evolve from a growth to a longer term free cash flow generating company. Tesla's not there yet, so they continually have to fund themselves. And perhaps some of their boards of directors said, Elon, you're a stud. Like, you know, all of our profitability this last quarter came from holding some Bitcoin. Why don't we crystallize some of it?
Yeah.
And so so I have no problem with it. It's human nature. Yeah. I think if he's disciplined enough to buy it again at a higher price, when he becomes free cash flow positive, that's what he's supposed to do. And right. I would argue anybody who's not free cash flow positive, you issue debt at these artificially low rates. You fund your CapEx using predominantly debt, but then you peel off a little bit of that capital that you've raised and you do put it in Bitcoin because you want to borrow money when rates are low. Mm-hmm. And you also want to borrow in fiat because the $100 you borrowed today in fiat, when you pay it back in 10 years, it's only really worth in 10 years, you know, 75 cents or 75 bucks, right?
Yeah.
That's what fiat is.
So are you optimistic for the next 10 years?
I will always own Bitcoin. I'll tell you that. I will always own Bitcoin. I'm not optimistic about some of the things going on in the world, but I am optimistic about the hedges that are available. And this is a beautiful technological innovation, the most beautiful innovation I've seen. And to bring it back to Warren Buffett, you know, I sent out some tweets yesterday. I somewhat regret some of the things I said only because he is a bit of a hero, my hero. But here's the truth. Okay. If you don't do the intellectual, you don't actually ever have a Bitcoin wallet on your phone. If you've never experienced sending money around the world to an address that's on a ledger that's decentralized and it settles in 10 minutes, if you've ever tried to send an international money transfer on the same basis to somebody you've never met and you don't have their banking information, well, it's impossible to do. But this is what Bitcoin is. It is an ability to transfer digital energy anywhere in the world in 10 minutes. Okay. I mean, if you don't see the beauty of that, and I don't think Charlie Munger and Warren do, and I don't think they've actually done the work, because I think they're smart people. Mm. I don't think they've actually done the work. They are intellectually compromised because, well, they might own a ton of banks, which they do, and they may not want this to succeed because it may disintermediate their banking positions.
They're also not sending any wires personally or waiting on any deadlines or have any of those concerns or headaches.
Well, how about this? They live in the richest country in the world. And what you don't understand, and this is one thing I experienced, is the average American has no idea how different life is outside of the United States relative to the United States, just in terms of freedom of many different things, including freedom of transferring wealth. Okay. Like, you know, there's 180 something fiat currencies in the world. Yep. Tons of them are going to fail because they always do.
Yep.
And we're not always talking about the people in the United States that need to hedge themselves. There's other really more important places that you better get on your risk management bandwagon right now.
Yeah, I think there's also a big difference between 1950s America and today's America and today's world. And I'm not so sure Warren and Charlie understand it. I think Warren Buffett has a legendary career. Both of them do. I used to look up to him. A lot of the things he talked about and expounded. But I think today he might be a mid-level hedge fund manager. I'm not sure, or mutual fund manager.
I think that for sure mutual fund, because I'm not certain he's ever really shorted anything in his life.
Right.
He might have sold protection or bought protection implicitly on something, which is shorting something. But, you know, he had horrible things to say about the credit default swap market.
Yeah.
But now he employs credit default swaps.
Right.
Okay. You know, it's like everything. If you run an insurance company, you don't really understand how you have to manage risk until you see the products that are available to you to manage that risk. And I think the same thing will happen with Bitcoin over time. I don't want the fiat system to fail. Mm. The reality is it's failing all the time, but God forbid that the US dollar should actually fail. That's not what anybody wants, okay? You just actually want a parallel system in Bitcoin to be able to store your value, and you want the fiat currency to be able to smooth volatility in terms of a COVID event. Now, the mathematics will indicate that the debasing of the currency has accelerated, okay? That's just the way it is. but it doesn't mean it has to fail. And, you know, a lot of these guys that are Bitcoiners, you know, I don't want it to fail. I'll just go on record of saying that. I think the risks are increasing that it will, but we better be careful what we wish for sometimes, right? And Bitcoin is a store of value. It's a technology. It's materially different from a fiat currency. And fiat currencies are still going to be the basis of trade, international trade, because that's just going to be the bigger component in the short term. In the long term, yes. Can we all go to a Bitcoin standard? Yes. Is it going to happen in my lifetime? Unlikely, I would say, in my lifetime. In the lifetime of my kids, much more likely. But again, I'm not going to put a time on it. And Pierre Richard, I love you, man. I mean, that's a bold statement. I will take the other side of that bet. Not because I don't think that we're both fighting the same battles, or but that's a big number, okay? That's just a big number.
Yeah. Well, it was a bold prediction. Yeah. I appreciate your levity. You know, I think it's needed. I think we're all trying to sort through what we're trying to, what we're going through and what's happening. And I think that, you know, your experience brings a lot of weight to the situation. And we'll see how it plays out. You know,
well, you just do it because you have kids, because you love your country. You know, we are blessed that we can actually speak fairly freely. You know, we can call out some big guns, like, you know, Warren Buffett certainly doesn't give a crap what I think of him. Sure. But there's people that he's influencing that he could be damaging, and he doesn't understand some of the damage he could be causing. Because again, if you own zero Bitcoin, you are taking a lot bigger risk than if you just have a small portfolio allocation. It's that simple. It's only math. It's very, very simple. Nothing's 100% certain, but if Bitcoin goes to the prices I think it can go to, and that's meaningfully higher than $500,000, which is the market cap of gold, that's just not even a stopping point. Okay. Gold will be subsumed. The market cap of gold will be subsumed by Bitcoin. Doesn't mean gold won't exist. It'll just mean that Bitcoin will be larger. Big deal. What if it, you know, what if it does get to $1 to $2 to $3 million of Bitcoin? Who's the knucklehead that said don't buy it at 60 because it's a bubble? Well, there's lots of them out there.
Yeah, that's gonna be brutal. It's gonna be a wild ride. I'd love to see it play out. I really appreciate your words and thoughts. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed the conversation.
Me too, man. Really, really. This is as technical as we've ever gone, as I've ever gone on a podcast. You have been 100% on top of your questioning, and we live a similar thought process. There's always a price. You have to be managing your risk accordingly. There is risks in the price to the downside of Bitcoin. There always has been, but the reality is the asymmetric opportunity in Bitcoin is just too crazy to overlook because somebody says it's a Ponzi or it's used for extortion or it's disgusting. Those words are lazy.
Yeah. I don't think you're ever going to retire.
I actually probably won't, you know what? Because it's just, it's in my blood. You
know, too many people need your help and you have conviction.
No, you know what?
It's wild. You have a vision and you see it. And, you know, I think a lot of people that work in the, what we'll call your industry. And I hate to say that because it's broader than that. It's bigger than that. But our transactional nature.
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah.
So.
Well, you have to lower your time preference, guys. Like that's all it is. Like, let's talk in. Hopefully, I'm around in 20 years. How about we do this, Cedric? Let's talk in 10 years, okay? You and I. Let's please talk in 10 years.
Well, we'll set that talking, up, and okay? Hopefully, we'll talk before that. Yes, let's
continue. I know we will.
Talking.
I know
Thank
we
you will. So okay. much. I really appreciate
so,
this.
And likewise, it's been really, really fun. So thanks for everything you do, and we'll talk soon. All right.
Thank you so much.
All right, buddy.
Greg Foss. On high yield trading, credit default swaps, Bitcoin as the anti-fiat, and the most beautiful asymmetric bet of all time, right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dig the chats, please subscribe, drop a 5-star review, and share a link to the pod with your friends and family. That's the best way to spread the word so I can keep grinding out thought-provoking conversations about Bitcoin. Keep learning and keep stacking. This is Cedric. Peace.